from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today we'll start with getting some expert advice on how to survive a zombie apocalypse.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Okay. I will chat with the artist and the engineer who are creating kinetic public art as part of the Da Vinci Pursuit.
And I'll talk with pianist Becky Archibald about her new jazz CD. And we'll have our arts calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Are you prepared for the zombie apocalypse? Well, the Indiana Historical Society is here to help. Sharon Gamble invited Aaron Kelly, Director of Education and Community Engagement, into our studios to get us ready for the zombies.
All right, you do a lot of intriguing things in your programming, but I was not prepared for you to be programming to help us prepare for the zombie apocalypse.
You know, it's coming. We got to make sure we're ready for it.
All right. So, of course, I have to ask, how did this get started?
Well, you know, at the Historical Society, we have a couple of exhibits up right now. You Are There, 1955, Ending Polio, mm-hmm. and You Are There, 1913, A City Underwater. Now, some of the underlying themes to these exhibits deal with public health and then with disaster relief and recovery.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, zombies bring those things together beautifully.
Plus, you have a fighting chance of getting kids in.
Well, you know, yeah, we've actually designed two programs, one on June 19th, which is actually adults only focused, and then on June 20th, sort of a kid-friendly version of this night. You know, these themes of public health, the spread of viruses, how we prepare for disasters, how we deal with emergencies, these are kind of scary topics. And zombies, well, yes, as a genre, are scary. They're also fun. So this is a lighthearted way, really, to explore some of these deeper themes in the exhibit and to really and truly, I think, give people some skills and knowledge that could make a difference in their lives.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. When I first saw the flyer and before I turned it over, I thought, I wonder if this somehow ties together some of the You Are There exhibits because of what you just said. But I love how you've had a little bit of fun with it, too. You learn about preventing viruses, you know, coordinated response strategies to the brain-eating hordes.
Yes, yes. Well, this has been exciting for us. We've been able to forge some really fantastic partnerships to put this together. So we are working with experts from the Department of Homeland Security regarding how they set up command centers to address natural disasters and other emergencies. So mm-hmm. they're actually going to be on site with a mock command center that they'll have
cool.
set up. Because really to address a pandemic like virus Z and the brain-eating hordes, it's the same kind of response strategy they use during flood events and tornadoes. So there's a lot of parallels there. We're also working with the Department of Health to help understand how we can all prevent the spread of the zombie virus, which is an awful lot like the influenza virus in terms
Go
of
figure.
How you prevent it. yeah, and then we're having a lot of fun, too, with a couple of groups, Trade School Indy. They're going to be doing a quick bartering class, teach you how to barter, because clearly, you know, credit cards, cash, they're going to be nothing.
They're not
going to
work after the zombie invasion.
Come.
Yeah.
So they're going to teach you how to barter. And then we've been working with some folks from the South Side, a group called Indiana Self-Defense, and they are a group of preppers. So these are folks who know how to pack a bug-out bag, know how to filter water.
A
bug-out bag. In the case of an emergency, you really should have, you know, a go bag that if something tornado or something comes and you've got to leave your house quickly, it's a quick bag that has the essentials you need, maybe a little first aid kit, your prescription medicines, a flashlight,
some canned food,
something like that. Hmm. So they're going to, you know, go through some demonstrations on what you might want to consider packing for kind of your get up and go and grab bag, your bug out bag. But they're also going to teach you how to filter water, different options you have
really?
For starting fires,
huh.
You know, different kinds of matches and that sort of thing. They're going to do some demos on how you can create shelter out on the run in the environment. It'll be a lot of fun. I think folks are going to learn a lot during these programs.
And I love that you've also inserted a little bit of the capturing oral history tradition in there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. This was, to a degree, inspired by a book called World War Z, An Oral History of the Zombie Apocalypse by Max Brooks. And what Max Brooks did in his book was tell the story of the zombie apocalypse through a series of oral histories. And he modeled that off of The Good War, which is a classic World War II oral history collection by Studs Terkel. We have a really amazing oral history collection at the Indiana Historical Society, and we have an oral historian on staff. So we're also kind of programming into the evening an opportunity for folks to learn about oral history, to learn about things that you and I can do just in our everyday life when talking particularly with our elders and capturing their memories.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if the zombies come, you know, humanity, somebody's going to have to save their stories, and we want to train you on how to do that.
I should have asked at the beginning, how does someone become a zombie? I've forgotten my zombie lore.
In our backstory, it's a mutated virus.
Okay.
And actually, the programming at the Historical Society, you're going to learn more about the backstory of how the virus spread and how the History Center sort of became the epicenter of a limited outbreak here in Indianapolis. You know, when you come to the Indiana Historical Society and you go into one of our You Are There exhibits, we ask you to suspend your disbelief and to pretend like you really are stepping back in time.
Right.
Well, with this program, the moment you step through our doors, we are asking you to, again, pretend with us and to play with us that zombies are real, that there's this whole rich backstory of how this virus was created and why the Historical Society is involved. And by participating in the programming that night, you're going to learn more about that backstory.
What are you doing to adapt the adult program to kids?
Well, you know, this is where our partners have been fantastic, and we've gotten some really good advice from the folks from the Department of Health and Homeland Security about how to talk about these issues with kids. So for the kid-friendly night on June 20th, which is a part of our Museum Nights series, so free admission, 4 to 8 p.m., we're going to tweak things a little bit and talk about how kids can prepare disaster pet kits. So how they can prepare things that they need to grab and go if something happens and they need to take care of their pet. It's a way to talk about disasters in a way that's less scary than something happening to mom or dad.
Right.
We're going to have some service animals there that night as well. And we'll have some crafts. We'll have some just fun kind of stuff for kids to make that's zombie related. Oh, and face painting. Kids can get all decked up like the zombies.
Photo opportunities. I see it now.
Yeah.
So fun. What a quirky, crazy, I mean, you've done a lot of interesting outreach, but have you ever done anything quite like this? I mean, setting the zombie aspect aside.
But. No, this is new for us, but it's been fun. I tell you what's been great about it, not only the community partners, but the institution has gotten involved with it. I have everybody from our security staff to our maintenance staff to people in other departments all asking to participate and be a part of this program. So
Aww.
It's been really wonderful just from beginning to end in planning this.
Oh, you might have to. It might become a franchise. It might become a serial.
You never know.
Yeah. Ugh, love it. Talk about Canal Nights.
Canal Nights, every Thursday night we have we have concerts on the canal, and you can purchase tickets for those, or you can sit across the canal in sort of a grassy knoll area and watch them for free.
Mm-hmm.
But also, every Thursday night this June and July, from 4 to 8 p.m., we are free. And we are encouraging families just to come down on Thursday evenings, come down to the canal, come to the History Center. All of our exhibits will be open. And each Thursday night, we'll have additional family-friendly programming going on inside the building. It'll be a mixture of crafts and games and performances. And, of course, on June 20th, zombie face painting. But it's really just a great way for families to come downtown, enjoy the canal, and enjoy the History Center this summer.
What is the response of kids who are coming to the History Center for the first time? Is there kind of a universal thing that they gravitate to, a universal aspect of exhibits or something about the center? I mean, do they like gather around the clock that runs backwards? Or
they really, I think, you know, it's a beautiful building, but when you walk in, even little kids have a wow. This is a big place. It's a very formal place. And then you get inside our exhibits, and where we let you touch things, and we let you ask questions, and we let you pretend, and we let you play. And children in particular really do seem to respond to the You Are There exhibitions, and that idea of stepping back in time and pretending like they've gone back into the past, that is something that definitely resonates well with the children that come through.
Great opportunity to bring multiple generations of a family, too.
Absolutely. There's so much story sharing that takes place inside those exhibits.
And maybe open kids' eyes to new things they might ask their grandparents or their aunts and uncles about.
And that's one of the greatest things. We love it when we see that happen and get to hear those stories that are shared between grandparents, parents, and kids.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you've opened a new You Are There since the last time you were in our studios. Can we talk about the new one?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's called A City Underwater, and it tells the story of the Great Flood of 1913, which largely it devastated the west side of Indianapolis. And at that time, you know, you didn't have FEMA, you didn't have the Department of Homeland Security, you didn't have large coordinated national responses to emergencies. So the mayor of Indianapolis at that time reacted quickly to this flood, pulled together a lot of community leaders, and a series of relief stations were set up all over Indianapolis where people who were displaced by the flood could go and receive aid, food and clothing, try to track down loved ones who were missing. So we've recreated one of those relief stations, and you get to come in and meet with some of the volunteers working there, and also volunteer yourself. You can help pack food parcels and help bundle up some of the materials that were going out to people.
What caused that flood?
Poor land use decisions, and this is part of what, when you come to the exhibit, we have a content room, a more traditional exhibit that you can learn about this. We built the city up on the side of a river on a floodplain and didn't really think about what would happen in terms of building an urban environment next to a river and taking away the capacity for flood waters to naturally seep back into the ground. So the waters had nowhere to go other than straight into the city, straight into the west side.
Wow. And I'm sure you had access to a lot of photos documenting the flood. What was it about this particular one that made it call out to you, this is the You Are There inspiration?
The photo is of the relief station, and there's a gentleman in the foreground just looking straight into the camera. And for me, that was the element of the photo that really grabbed me, of this guy sitting there at this table just looking tired and harried, and he's got a cup of coffee or some kind of mug in his hand. And then there are some women and actually some children in the background, and it looks like they're helping to possibly, they're either picking up or preparing some of the relief bundles that are going out. So it's just this mixture of people. We haven't been able to track down who they were. We don't know their individual stories, but clearly this flood affected their lives. And it's just this wonderful snapshot of a community coming together, trying to get through it all.
And a great opportunity, too, to imagine, as you said, what it was like before we had digital communication. I mean, in 1913, a lot of families wouldn't even have had a landline telephone yet, let alone be able to use it when they're forced out of their home by a flood. And also fewer ways to spread the word to get help, both in the moment of evacuation, but also if you've lost your home and all your belongings, you have to depend on your church or your temple or the kindness of strangers, literally, to get you back on your feet.
Very much. And that's why when you come to the exhibit, the content room portion is really about the science of flooding and the backstory, the meteorology of it all. Mm-hmm. But once you walk through that fog screen and walk back into time, it really is the story of helping each other, of people coming together and really looking at your community and thinking about the resources and assets you have and how you can pull that together to help people in need.
Sharon Gamble with the Indiana Historical Society's Director of Education and Community Engagement, Aaron Kelly. Preparing for the zombie apocalypse, When the Dead Rise, Will You Be Ready? Is at the Indiana History Center on Wednesday, June 19th at 7 p.m. Now, that one's for adults only and includes adult beverages from Sun King Brewing, which apparently helps to keep the zombies away. And there's also one, a family-friendly session on dealing with brain-eating hordes that's on June 20th at the History Center. You can get your tickets and get more information at indianahistory.org. Again, indianahistory.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Artist Quincy Owens and engineer Luke Crawley are working together on a kinetic public art sculpture called the Kabikoscope, made possible by the organization The Da Vinci Pursuit. Travis DiNicola spoke to them about their winning design.
Quincy, Luke, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you guys here.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And congratulations. are in store for winning this competition. You know, a couple months ago, here on Art of the Matter, we had Mark Kiesling in from Da Vinci Pursuit talking about this competition, this idea of bringing together, you know, art and science and some sort of kinetic sculpture that'd be a public artwork and all these things. And I'm like, really? Okay. So, you know, it's a pretty exciting idea. And you guys officially won it. So, Quincy, you're the artist. Luke, I'm assuming you're sort of the engineer of science behind this. Is that right?
Yeah, sure.
Well, tell me about the sculpture. What did you guys come up with?
Well, Quincy,
you can start away.
Totally took both of us. I saw the proposal because I'm the guy that's in the art world, and this, I think, reached out to the art world more than it did to the science community.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it, and Luke and I are dear friends, and he's the science guy, and I'm the art guy. I looked at him and was like, man, this has got our name written all over it.
Yeah.
Let's go for it.
And Luke, you were thinking, what is Quincy getting me into?
Well, I used to think that, but, you know, we've been hanging out for a while. Nothing really surprises me anymore with mm-hmm. Quincy. So, yeah, he emailed it to me, and I read through it, and there were a lot of possibilities, and this was the one that we felt was going to work the best, had the most potential, and it sort of went from there.
Where did you guys start with this? I mean, one of the requirements, I know that the piece had to have some sort of kinetic aspect to it that people could be interactive with, that they would do something with their body that would cause something to happen mm-hmm. with the sculpture. Is that where you guys started, or did you start somewhere else?
God, where did we start? I think, thinking back about it, we really looked at all of the criteria in pretty broad strokes to try to hit on a lot of things, because there were like 8 or 9 criteria, which mm-hmm. we moaned and groaned about at first, but by the end of the project we were really grateful that we had those criteria, because sometimes it's really hard to build something from nothing. So we had mm-hmm. base blocks to work from there, and I think that artistically I wanted to use color. We had to make it move, so then it came to us pretty quickly that, oh, and then the other criteria was upscaling or reclaiming right. objects. Luke, I think it was you. You came up with the idea of using bicycle wheels just because of everything in the city that we enjoy to do with biking and the cultural trail and
sure.
how the city's becoming more bikeable, Indy Hub, all these other great things that are happening. We're like, we could totally get some bicycle wheels, and that can be our moving part. Plus, we thought about the feasibility of it. We didn't want to make some giant 10-ton sculpture that was going to have to move. That causes lots of serious engineering problems.
Yeah.
We both understand the mechanics of a bicycle. Him even still more than I do. We can make bicycle wheels move.
And that's sort of the main element, right, of the sculptural piece. And I'll ask you to describe it more in more detail for me in just a moment here. But the kinetic element, the interactive element, is that people will be able to get on it, whether they're sitting like on a bicycle and pedaling or using their hands to sort of move pedals. So there's a lot of different options that will sort of energize the sculpture, right? And then,
right.
then where does it go from there?
Well, essentially, and I guess maybe an underlying inspiration, it just sort of happened to coincide with, I teach physics in mm-hmm. high school, and we were actually doing a unit on light and how light mixes together, and so that's was part of the science aspect to the thing, was you have the mechanics and the kinetic experience, but also that you do get to see some the phenomenon of how light mixes together, which can be interesting because we're not as used to that as mixing paint, you know, growing up working with finger paints when you're 1 or 2 or 3, et cetera. So I've always found it interesting to teach that and to show that in class. It's really something you have to see.
Because light mixes differently than
yeah.
like
you
know, traditionally.
Is much different than visually. Yeah,
right, it's not just like,
still
you know, yellow and blue paint
like
mixed
lying
green.
To me. That is not what happens when you mix red and green. You
yeah.
are lying. He's like, no, really, man. I'm telling you.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of different aspects to it. Just the kinetic part and getting to see simple machines and gear ratios and that aspect as well is hopefully getting to see how light mixes together.
So so what happens when the bikes get pedaled? That okay. what happens next then?
Well, essentially, you know, and there'll be different combinations and different mm-hmm. variables that aren't yet figured out. But the bike will spin, and there are colored acrylic
yeah. We're
inserts
gonna have translucent colored plastics, basically like
sort of like
of
hard
glass.
Gels of mm-hmm. okay.
yeah yeah mm-hmm. but sturdy, thick. We're hoping to mess with some prisms also that will also help alter the light and make it do more interesting things, so
okay.
that know, in the end, yeah. you're standing under this thing.
A huge kaleidoscope, and so the wheels and the patterns are going to be on you and on the floor, essentially, on the ground.
Now, the one drawing I saw, it almost looks sort of like a tent roof type of structure. Is that right?
Yeah, our problem was we had too many design possibilities for it, which has actually been a really good thing. Everybody that's been involved that we've talked to were grateful and impressed by seeing the scope and the vision that we had mm-hmm. for this proposal, as opposed to just marrying ourselves to that one idea and making it our baby. We saw so many ways we could take all of our physics ideas of gears and motion and light, mm-hmm. and we could apply those into different aesthetic designs. So there's the big, you know, tent pagoda-like structure where we'll have, you know, it's not determined yet, but as many bicycle wheels as we can put in there with
sure.
as many
mm-hmm.
cranks, pulleys, levers, knobs, or whatever we can do to get them spinning, so that the more people are there or the more energetic the child is that wants to run mm-hmm. around and get them all going, the experience is always going to be different. Because mm-hmm. you also have to think about how light plays into this thing, and that's daylight, which will produce a different kind of light mm-hmm. at different times of day, and shadows, and it will cast the light in different directions and stretch it out. And then there's also at night, because we're going to set it up where this was another one of the restrictions, or not restrictions, but criteria, was that the sculpture was not allowed to use any electricity
okay.
or power other than from itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted
human-powered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I told Luke, I was like, this thing's going to look even more awesome at night.
Right.
But that means we have to have lights. So then there's the whole issue of creating mechanisms that also store energy
okay.
to power lights in the evening, because at night I think it's going to look breathtaking.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is going to be located in Fountain Square. Is that right? Or sort of in the Fountain Square area?
In the Fountain Square area. Mm-hmm. That's I've felt comfortable so far telling people it will be in the southeast
sure.
quadrant of downtown.
Okay. So yeah. also near the cultural trail.
Somewhere right in that area.
Okay. A lot of stuff, though, to work out still, but that's kind of exciting. I mean, it sounds like.
I'm an artist. He's a scientist. Obviously, we like problems, not solutions.
And this yeah. poses a lot of problems to work through. I mean,
yeah.
it sounds like. So, I mean, what's the process going to be for you two guys over the course of the summer? Because I know you want to try to have this sort of up and created,
right.
installed right by before winter, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the plan. Go
yep.
ahead.
Well, so I guess once all the logistics are worked out, you know, we meet with someone who knows a little bit more about engineering and welding per se mm-hmm. than we do. But really, it has a high feasibility. You know, I mean, cranks and gears and chains have been around a long time, and there's mm-hmm. there's a lot of stuff that you can do with them, and you know, even the lighting issue. Generators have been on bikes for a long time.
Sure.
Guys with headlights, and so building a generator into the actual wheel itself shouldn't be too much of an issue. Famous last words, maybe.
Yeah.
But.
Well, so we're excited. No. We need to have a for sure place to plop it down. Once
mm-hmm.
we've got that, then we really get to start rolling. And wherever we plop it down, let the people who are sharing the land take a look through our designs.
Right.
We're really collaborative people.
Right. And we
talk
also
them through where it's going to go from there.
Realize that there are a lot of people a lot smarter than we are
yeah.
that are listening to this and know how to do it right away.
And so if someone has an idea, actually,
yeah,
as far as how to
right.
jump in.
Call us.
Yeah.
I mean, Quincy, are you going to be doing this mainly in your studio? I mean,
Actually, we're hoping some of the work we'll be doing in the studio. And like mm-hmm. he said, you know, there's, you know, I'm a big fan of also a lot of the artwork I've been trying to do in the past year or so, especially, is involving other people other than myself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be the master of all of the solutions. I want to collaborate. That's how Luke and I started working together in the first place, is that I didn't want to be in the studio alone. So some of the work will be done in the studio. We do look to help support some local fabricators, some local plastics workers. Probably the most exciting thing as far as the community that I'm excited about is, although I'm not a full-time teacher anymore, Luke and I were both adamant about getting kids involved in this.
Sure.
So we're hoping that as this thing really gets rolling, right at near the beginning of the school year, all of these bicycle wheels are going to have these colored plastics cut and attached to them. And that's something that kids could totally do. And he could go with his schedule sometimes, and I could go with my schedule. And we could just use this as a physics experiment in a classroom where the
mm-hmm.
kids actually get to attach the plastics to the wheels. And then when they get to come down to see it one of these days when it's done, it wasn't just us that built it. There'll be kids all over the city that had a hand in building this also if we have our way, which is really
very
awesome.
Cool. So light, motion, energy, kinetics, community, all these things coming together. Luke, as a physics teacher, this is, I'm imagining, a little bit different type of project than what you normally work on, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's still somewhat, I view it somewhat as an extension of what I at least attempt to do in the class as far as, you know, labs and activities where the students get to manipulate things and see cool, have cool experiences, but it, you know, nothing on this scale. So it's pretty exciting.
And I forgot to add engineer, too. Now you guys get to be engineers as well.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, seriously, best of luck to you. And I can't wait to see how this turns out. It's a really exciting project. It's a really neat idea. And I know it's still got some phases to evolve through, but it should be a great journey for you both.
Yeah, we think so.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. Thanks for coming in to Art of the Matter.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with artist Quincy Owens and engineer Lou Crawley. You can learn more about their Kabikoscope sculpture and the Da Vinci Pursuit at thedavincipursuit.com. Just like it sounds, thedavincipursuit.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Do you know what we have on our calendar this week?
Does that have anything to do with our birthdays?
It has a lot to do with one of our birthdays. We have lots of things for you to do to celebrate your birthday this weekend.
Sure.
On our calendar we call,
What'll we do
for Travis's big day?
Of course. That sounds like a great idea.
It does, indeed.
I think Talbot Street and
Talbot Street Art Festival.
And,
yeah, and especially if you haven't gotten your present for Travis yet, there are lots of worthy things at the Talbot Street Art Festival, which is going on Talbot Street downtown between 10 and 6 this Saturday and 10 and 5 this Sunday. Lots of wonderful handcrafted stuff, great food, some music, and be sure you stroll up and down the neighboring streets because the neighbors always take advantage and either put out their own crafts in front of their homes or do a little yard sailing or what have you.
Yeah, it's always a great time.
It's a great time.
And some fun food, too.
Free admission.
Free admission. Hey, and speaking of the Pride Fest, along with the parade, of course, which is on Saturday downtown on Mass Ave, and then the big festival taking place on the lawn downtown. Then we've also got at the Arts Garden the Indie Pride 25th Anniversary Exhibition, which is up now at the Arts Garden through June 22nd. So yet more ways to celebrate Pride.
Indeed. Hey, speaking of the Arts Council, which runs the Arts Garden, they are making use of their Gallery 924 space at 924 North Pennsylvania Street for a June exhibition called the Self-Portrait Show. It's not just visual artists either. It's artists of all disciplines, and you can go check that out during their open hours. You can find out more at indiearts.org, the Self-Portrait Show at the Arts Council of Indianapolis, Gallery 924.
Hey, another great festival going on this weekend is the Independent Music and Arts Festival that's taking place. This is the 12th annual one, taking place at the Harrison Center for the Arts up at 16th and Delaware from noon to 8, and it's also being held in conjunction with the Handicraft Festival.
Oh, love that.
Yeah, so very fun stuff.
It is a big week for visual arts. Of course, First Friday this Friday, part of the IDOTA First Friday Art Tour, exhibitions all over the place. And you need to check all those out. Perfect weather, early June. Wow, what a great day to live in Indianapolis, and especially to go downtown to Mass Ave, to the Harrison Center, to the Arts Council of Indianapolis, to the Plaza downtown, and more.
Hmm. Very cool. Hey, Sharon, there's been a lot of talk about the Velocity Plan, which is the plan that IDI, Indianapolis Downtown Inc., is launching. It's a 5-year strategic planning process for downtown, and they've had lots of input from a lot of different civic leaders, and it involves arts and culture and public transportation and sports and building and commerce and all sorts of things. Well, what they're doing now is they're taking that out. They've been conducting a public survey, but they're taking it out into all the downtown neighborhoods, the residential neighborhoods, from June 10th through the 21st, and there's going to be a whole bunch of public meetings where they are looking for input from people who live downtown as well as work downtown and want to be a part of this. You can get more information at the Indianapolis Downtown Inc. Website, indiedt.com, and look for Velocity and get the schedule of where it is coming to your neighborhood.
Love it. Hey, you can step backwards in time at the Propylaeum. Check this out. You might have read about the Propylaeum in the Indianapolis Star this last Sunday. Nice article about their need to raise money to replace their
roof.
Wonderful wonderful roof, yeah. But they do a lot of public events, and this Sunday they're doing a backwards dinner at the Propylaeum. Their promotion starts out, how do you spell desserts backwards? Stressed. Have fun and learn new etiquette lessons. Dinner starts with an invitation to wear your clothes backwards. Tour the Victorian house. You see the backwards. You're going backwards in time to
works.
Victorian era. And you guessed it, you're going to take the tour backwards, and you're going to enjoy a three-course meal and the 30 points of etiquette backwards. So all of you who are fond of saying, life short, eat dessert first, I think this might be the event for you. It's going on this Sunday, June 9th at 4 p.m., and you can find out more at the Propylaeum's website, Propylaeum. I know you knew
That's
how to spell it.
It's easy for you to spell. Oh, cool. Very good.
Yeah.
Can you spell that backwards? No, don't.
Not without looking.
Hey, congratulations to Indie Irish Fest for the announcement that they are opening up an Irish Arts Academy of Indianapolis. And this is a really cool thing, because Irish Fest in the past has always raised money to promote Irish culture and provide scholarships for students studying Irish dance and Irish music. Well, what they're going to be doing now is offering classes to all ages and levels of experience in traditional song, dance, and language. And, classes in fiddle and flute and whistle, accordion, concertina, tenor banjo, mandolin, guitar, dulcimer, the budrain. This just sounds like a lot of fun. So very cool thing that they're doing in addition to all the dance classes. And so they will be doing this beginning in September, but they've just announced it now. And you can get more information, of course, at IndieIrishFest.com.
So you might be able to make your toast. Well, you already can make your Irish Fest toast in Gaelic, but our listeners can join you as well. Hey, this coming Thursday night, there's a free community concert at Garfield Park at the McAllister Amphitheater by the Philharmonic Orchestra of Indianapolis. That's Thursday evening, June 13th at 7 p.m. Take your dad for an early Father's Day treat.
That sounds delightful.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, we need to start thinking about Father's Day, too.
We do.
And gifts for that as well. Hey, there's a series of lectures on Byzantine iconography that are open to the public and free, and they take place in the evening, Mondays, at the Indianapolis Arts Center. And the first one just happened. Next one, of course, is June 10th, and these are all through Dr. George Cortis and his team of iconographers who've written about the iconography at the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church in Carmel and are now working on the iconography at the St. George Antiochian Orthodox Church in Fishers. And all these lectures, are free at the Indianapolis Arts Center.
Free is good. Love that. Hey, if your dad likes high-tech films... this is a stretch, I know, but you can go behind the scenes of the highest grossing film of all time at the new Avatar exhibit at the Children's Museum. It doesn't open until after Father's Day, so you'll have to create a little gift certificate
That's
to put
right.
in his card. It opens on June 22nd, but it's an interactive experience that lets you sort of be a stand-in member of James Cameron's crew, and you can figure out how they use science to create the world of the film. You can learn more at childrensmuseum.org, childrensmuseum.org.
Very good. Hey, last thing I've got, Sharon, at the Indiana State Fairgrounds coming up on June 15th in the West Pavilion, the second annual Latino Expo. And this is from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. And then there's a dance and DJ contest from 4 to 6 p.m. And everything Latino culture will be represented there. You can get more information at IndianaLatinoExpo.org. Again, this is at the State Fairgrounds on June 15th.
Fabulous. Well, a happy birthday a tiny bit early to Mr. DiNicola.
Well, thank you, Sharon. And you've got one coming up, too,
I've got one coming up later in the month, so woohoo! It's Art of the Matter birthday month here.
All right. And
you can find out how we're celebrating and join us for our calendar we call
What Will We Do
again next week.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Composer and pianist Becky Archibald loves her summer camp in France. In fact, her new CD was inspired by her residency at the Dordogne Jazz Summer School. And Sharon Gamble invited Becky in to learn about this new turn in her career and about how immersion in jazz has changed her as a person and as a musician.
So, Becky, you were trained as a classical musician, but for years and years, you've been playing in a style that nobody can quite figure out what to call. Okay. A little new age, a little jazz, a little...
Neoclassical, sort of.
Neoclassical, yeah. So, you'd been writing for more than a decade, about a decade, when this opportunity came up. And tell us about your inspiration, you and jazz.
Oh, well, I mean, there were several things that kind of led up to it, but I distinctly remember my son had a friend whose dad played bass, and he came over to pick his son up one day, and the dad, I asked the dad to listen to me play, and I thought maybe we could play together sometime. And he said, so I played a piece, and he said, "I don't know what you're doing."
Well, now that's not confidence inspiring for a musician.
Wait a minute. I thought jazz players could just start playing. I thought I could just start playing and they could start playing and we would just, but I didn't know about the maps. You know, I didn't know about the charts. And so that's what I was confused about.
For people who are hearing our conversation who also don't know, who think it's just that magical and go to jazz clubs and listen and they're just amazed. What does that look like? What are jazz musicians actually looking at that allows them to improvise but stay with the general storyline, so to speak?
Well, it's so much there's so much less on the page than on a piece of classical music where everything is written out, every note, every crescendo and decrescendo and staccato and all that. It's the tune of the song, and then the chord changes are listed above that, and that's pretty much what you follow. And then as you go through the tune, you then make some decisions about who's going to solo, and then you just kind of circle around it, and you learn over the years, and it's going to take me 25 more years probably, but all these things that you can do based on what you see on the page and how you can go improvise, I want to say a different word, but expand on what's there, but stay within the chords that are
within
that
the
are
parameters.
Listed.
So you really, really need to know your theory to know how you're going to get from that.
Well, it's interesting because
F to that B flat.
I mean, I found that you kind of have to go at it this way and that way and this way and that way. But there are people who play totally by ear, and they say they don't know theory, and yet their ears tell them everything, and they can do amazing stuff because they are so good with their ears.
Mm-hmm.
But they might not know what the meaning of a C7 sharp 9 with a flat whatever, you know. If you wrote it down, but they can just trust their ears.
They can do it. It's instinct.
And other people, I can pass a theory test really well. But I am still developing my ear, and I think because you work so much on what you see, and you try to mimic what you see on the page when you're playing classical music, it just doesn't seem like there's quite enough time on the ear training in the classical training. There really should be, but so
in some ways. That classical training is a little bit of an obstacle to get over. Well it just serves you well. It sometimes gets in the way.
Yes. I know people who say, "Oh, I wish I could read better. I would be so much more better of a jazz musician if I could read better." And I think, well, I wish I could do what you do. You can feel it better.
Isn't that the glorious thing about music, though, is there are so many skill sets, and you know, you have some friends who can sight read, you can put the music upside down on the chart, on the piano, and they can read it from sight, and other people can't sight read to save their soul, but they have innate rhythm.
Gifted.
Yeah.
It's just, they've got it. They got it in the pocket, as they say.
Yeah. So you had this conversation, this fellow parent says, "I have no idea what you're doing." And after the shock, you go, "Wait a minute, what do you mean?"
Yeah. And then I just started asking questions and trying to understand. And I went to a jazz workshop, and the guy that led the workshop said, "Does anyone have questions?" And I asked him a very clear, pointed question that he could have answered. And instead he said, "Why don't you just enjoy the mysteries of jazz?"
Well, boy, that really set me to find the answer.
You threw know, down just, the gauntlet, Diane.
You're not going to... I'm not giving up that easy. So when I wrote the grant for the Arts Council of Indianapolis, the Creative Renewal Grant proposal, it was, I want to learn jazz and I want to be immersed so that I'm not just kind of piddling at it once a week or once every week, every other week with a teacher, but I'm really forced to do it.
And it's like learning a second language
right,
yeah,
right.
by immersion.
Yeah, which I like to do that too. Next, that's the next thing. But
how,
yeah.
How did you find this particular school?
I Googled Europe Jazz School.
Seriously, I
yes,
love
I
that.
Did. Yeah, and I met several others that said they did the same thing, and just fell in love with what they said on the website and thought, wow, this is the place I want to go. I like the idea of the communal meals. I'd never really had I didn't know French, and I didn't really have a dream of going to France.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I've been, now it's a constant dream of just, I love it so much there. And it was just in this little tiny village called Monteton. So small, there's no cheese shop and there's no bakery. It's just a tiny place with a church and a couple of restaurants and some homes scattered, you know, far from each other.
Sounds ideal.
Yeah. And well, it's very, very, very quiet. And somehow they have let people know, and people from all over the world come to play together, to study and learn and play together.
So how did you find the others who weren't insiders already, who weren't already conversant with jazz? How did you find others?
Here or at the school?
At the school.
They put you in groups. So
no mainstreaming, huh?
And actually, they put me in the advanced group, and I said, oh, I'm in the wrong group. I need to go in the beginners. And the woman that ran that said, you're advanced. You know this and you know that. And I was a little intimidated, but the people were so kind, which I've also found here. People are so kind and helpful and wanting to share what they know, that I did okay. I did all right that first time.
Beyond the ear training that, as you say, is a work in progress, what are some of the key lessons you learned about what differentiates jazz from, say, classical?
Well, the idea of rubato is something that I use a lot as a pianist, as a classical pianist, and then writing my own piano music. Rubato is just giving yourself time and not having to stick with the metronomic pulse.
Right.
Jazz, that metronome is the key to your freedom. And I just didn't understand that at all, because I wanted to just be free with the pulse, but you can't really play together.
Because you cause a train wreck.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so it's just stubborn me, you know, having to be told over and over, you really need more time with that metronome. As a composer, you do things, and then you have to keep reminding yourself to do that same thing when you write, when you improvise. But as a composer, I love space. I love space between the notes. I like tension too. I don't like resolving things too soon. And in jazz, if you're not a blower, if you're not playing saxophone or trumpet or anything that you blow, it's easy to think that I've got to keep going. I've got to keep filling in, or else I'm going to look like I don't know what I'm doing, which is the wrong thing, because give yourself time to breathe. And then you just sound a little cooler, you know. So I've learned that. That's a great question. I could probably I'll probably go home and write essays about how to answer that and what I wished I'd said today.
We'll talk about it the next time we're together. And your collaborators and folks who've watched our television show got to hear your collaborators. How did they are longtime marquee names on the jazz scene. Mm-hmm. What did you do to coax them to work with you?
I don't know. I met Jim Farrelly at the Y, of all places, and we had seen each other's photo on each other's CDs at Page's Music at the store. So we sort of recognized each other, and he said, you know, if you ever need a saxophone player, let me know.
Cool.
And I said, yeah.
Now that
actually,
you mention it,
I'm just starting to write some jazz. So he was just... My champ. I mean, he just, anytime I wrote something, I would say, can you come and test it out? And he would, what was wonderful was that he's so excellent that I would think, wow, I really wrote a great piece because I got to hear the best person play it. But on the other hand, he really likes what I write. You know, it was just.
It's a good collaboration.
Awesome.
Which is what you need. It strikes me that you need trust. Uh-huh. Every bit as much in jazz as you do in, say, classical chamber music.
Oh yeah.
You got to know that other person's there.
Right. Oh yeah. So and then I had known PJ for quite a while, and he's PJ Inger's trumpet player and also the designer of the CD. But anytime he's in the room, he just keeps saying, "You can never do anything wrong. Everything you do is right." He's so encouraging.
Wow.
Every note you choose is right. There's no wrong notes. So he's a wonderful collaborator. And then just kept meeting more people through them. And, you know, Gene Markowitz, who love. I mean, he's he's so gifted and so generous and so also so kind. Just, you know, everyone works so hard at the sessions. No one ever said that was good enough. Mm. Everyone said, "Let's do it again. Let's. I think we can do it better." I remember one take, one piece called "If You Only Knew." We had it. We wanted the metronome. I had the metronome marking. I think at 104 quarter note equals 104. Mm-hmm. And then someone suggested, "Why don't we pull it back a little bit?" So we pulled it back to 100, which is a barely anything. Taped the whole thing, discussed it. We all decided we need to bring it up a little bit. We brought it back up. But just, it was just so so cool that everyone was so open to trying different things and just keep doing it until we get the right take. And then when it was time to go, it was like, oh, let's just do it again for fun, because it's so much fun, because every time you play it, it's different. You hear new ideas, and one person's idea encourages the next person's idea, who kind of sends it on to another person, and they kind of take that and go with that, and it's fascinating. It's just,
Sharon Gamble with composer and pianist Becky Archbold. You can hear Becky and friends play music from her new CD, Midnight at Mont Etten, on Tuesday evening, June 25th, at the Indiana Landmark Center. And you can learn more at beckyarchibald.org. Now we're going to take a listen to the title track of her new CD. Thank you. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com. Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I get a preview of this year's Early Music Festival.
I'll get inside the Museum of Miniatures.
Ooh! Very smart.
And to wrap things up, I'll chat with outgoing IMA Contemporary Art Curator Lisa Freiman. Plus, there'll be our calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.